The fourth and final case for oral argument today is number A22-75, Fossey versus Fossey. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. I want to apologize for being behind scheduled. We had three cases today that ended up taking a little bit more time than usual, especially the third case, which had a lot of participants. And so apologize for keeping you waiting. But it doesn't mean we have any less time for your case. Still, you know, the same time limits will apply. But counsel for appellant, you may begin and by introducing yourself and your client and then beginning your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Margaret Murphy, and I represent appellant Anne Fossey, who is seated in the bench here. And with him is his partner, Lorna Rocky. May it please the court?
Yes, you may begin.
I can't read it. The number one reason that this court should order reunification is that...
I'm sorry, can you speak up just a little bit?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah.
The number one reason that this court should order reunification therapy is that this child is failing in every major area of her life. It's been found throughout parental alienation that these are typical problems for a child. Her mother describes her as needing a safe room, suffering from panic attacks, being afraid to have the windows open, but then insists that she is a typical teenager. That's not like any typical teenager I have ever known. I'm not saying kids don't have troubles, but the number of these troubles and the way that she is mimicking her own parent, her own mother's fears, is only typical of alienated children. This child should be given the opportunity to understand what has happened to her and the chance to succeed in life. The referee decided this case on the best interest factors rather than on endangerment. And endangerment is clearly the rule. Mr. Fossey effectively lost all custody of his daughter without any opportunity to be heard. To experience such a dramatic change in custody, there should have been a showing of endangerment. There was just an order without an investigation of any kind. For a long time, Mr. Fossey didn't understand at all why he was not being allowed to see his daughter. Ms. Fossey made allegations of sexual impropriety, but none of those mandated reporters ever reported it. No one. No one said anything about it until we pointed out that all of them were mandated reporters, and why wasn't there any kind of a criminal investigation?
Ms. Murphy, am I correct that your argument is contrary to the child's therapist or the views of the child's therapist? If we were to accept your argument, we would have to either disagree with or somehow countermand what her therapist has recommended for her.
I think that's true, Your Honor, except for the therapist was he was a child therapist, but he knew nothing about parental alienation. And he never involved, normally in a therapy for a child, both parents talk with the therapist. This therapist refused to speak to my client for a long time and never spoke to him for the first year and something of therapy. So he wasn't seeing any of the alienation. And, of course, the child wasn't bringing it up. She didn't know to do that. So, yes, I guess it is going against the therapist. But if you look at what Mr. Reitman, a psychologist, has written, an expert on alienation, he found that alienation existed and believed that Mr. Fossey was a child-focused parent and should be parenting his child.
I mean, wasn't there evidence, I think, from the therapist and others that the child's fears were genuinely held, and that there would be a setback in her therapy if she were to, if she were required to participate?
There were some people who found that there was something to what she was saying. The first psychologist is Goldfarb. Mr. Goldfarb is a well-known man. He found no such troubling aspect and never recommended that Mr. Fossey not see his child again. The first notion at all that he shouldn't be seeing the child came from the guardian ad litem, and then from Dana McKenzie, neither of whom have any psychological background.
Wasn't the appointment of Ms. McKenzie to do this, wasn't that, didn't your client agree to that?
I think he did, yes. That was before my time, but yes, I mean, his attorney thought it would be a good idea. I don't understand why she was appointed at all, but yes, he did. We were talking about where the level of parental alienation and how we determine that. But if you look at Dana McKenzie's report, she's actually using signs of alienation to say that there was no alienation. So she clearly did not understand the argument at all. And I put that in. I'm sorry, Dr. Reitman did include the signs of alienation in his submissions, and those are on file. But one of them is that the child will insist this is all of her own doing, and that's clearly there. And if you look at the behaviors of mom and child, they're identical. Izzy was a happy, healthy, normal kid. And all of a sudden, she has all the paranoid features that her mother has. You know, the locking the doors, thinking that Anne Fosse and Lorna Rocky are doing all kinds of ridiculous things to their house. And they didn't even know where they lived. These people are old enough where they would not be running up to people's windows and banging. That just is not part of it. And one of the things she said was that they called her and accused her of being fat. You know, and as we started talking about it, it said, well, yeah, they were trying to sell me something. Well, that wasn't my client. That was somebody trying to sell her diet products. But she had turned that into it. And not that particular one, but Izzy follows everything that Ms. Fossey has said. So that, too, is a sign of alienation.
But just reading the district court's order, it came through loud and clear to me that the district court was relying a lot upon Izzy's credibility and her testimony, and goes out of the way several times to say, you know, that she finds the child credible and her testimony credible, and that every, and you can tell me if you don't think the record supports this, but that I think that that every therapy professional that's been involved with her believes she's credible. You know, as an appellate court, we defer to credibility findings, you know. So how can we reverse this decision given just the multitude of credibility findings about the court here?
Because none of the people who are finding her credible have any history in parental alienation. And Dr. Reitman found clearly that there was parental alienation. And I think that this is something that will come before you many, many times because it isn't something that the rank-and-file therapist knows about. It's something entirely new. But not only should you be looking at Izzy's credibility, but also look at her life right now. I mean, that child has no chance of success at this point. She went from being a child almost entering a baccalaureate program to a child failing high school. So far, we've had 39 days of high school this year, and she has missed all or part of 23 of them. She's not attending school. So that's one huge red flag that I hope will make you think twice about whether or not you should consider her allegations credible in that she is not responding. It's been 5 years since she's seen her father. She should be improving, not falling down the cliff, as she so clearly is. Another really strange thing about this case is, so mom is saying she needs a panic room, she's got this, she's got that, and what's she dealing with her current therapist? She's dealing with changes from childhood to adulthood. Well, that doesn't even address the situation. If there was any sexual abuse in the past, you'd think that they would want to address it, but they are not addressing it at all. Even Ryan, oh, I'm forgetting the first therapist's name, but even he did not deal directly with any kind of sexual abuse. He only dealt with her day-to-day anxieties. So I think that speaks volumes for what's going on here. I believe that the number one reason you should find that reunification is appropriate is to give this child a chance of success. She has done nothing but gone downhill from the very first that she started not seeing her dad. And normally, reunification therapy is extremely difficult. But I think that the closeness between father and daughter is such that that link will remain. It might take a little bit, but what we are asking for is that you order reunification therapy, and then we started off with the therapist and Izzy at school, after school, via Zoom. That way, mom...
At what age do kids get to make up their own mind about who they want, which parent they want to... I mean, why, setting aside everything else, why shouldn't a now, I think, probably 16-year-old kid say, you know what, I just don't want to spend time with him, whatever the reason. And why should what is it in the record? Because that's what we have to deal with,
right.
Deferring to the district court's credibility determinations, would compel a different result.
Well, if you look
I guess I'm talking about Chip's cases now, sorry. I'm transitioning
but,
here.
But there are similarities, absolutely.
Yeah.
So if you look at the totality of the record, there were two OFPs in the beginning. Izzy wrote her own OFP against her mother. And Mr. Afassi filed it, but she wrote it. And it comes off as an 11-year-old. And for some reason, the referee would not allow that into evidence. She can speak of her own mind. And then she's saying, no, I can't stand the drinking, I can't stand this, but it's there. It's in the record as historically as part of her OFP. And it's only after that Ms. Fossey makes an OFP against Mr. Fossey. So, and I can't remember your question, which is really, really bad, but
It was just you pointed to some things in the record that
right.
would say...
Right,
maybe less weight should be put on the daughter's preferences
because she's
even
been
though
so
she's
right.
you know 16. Okay,
17 though. Just, but you know the reason that we still go forth, you know, waiting another year and then approaching her would be one way of doing this certainly. But she's in high school now. She could still turn this around. She would probably have to go to her next year of high school. But she's a really smart kid. Who's completely throwing away her life. And that's why Mr. Fossey really wants to see something happen now while we still have some control. And she has the opportunity to work with a therapist to figure out what actually happened. Because she probably doesn't know anymore. But that is why I am thinking that we need to go through this case. I mean, so many strange things happened. You know, all these people, Dana McKenzie is on the stand and said that she asked her ethicist, if she should have reported it, and he said it was up to her, and she chose not to. I don't know about you, but I don't have an ethicist. But if it was up to her and she chose not to, how seriously was she taking this issue? And Mr. Goldfarb certainly...
So that's your supposition, though, correct?
I mean,
that's your supposition that she's not to be believed because she didn't report it to the police? There's no expert testimony in the record on that, is there?
There is not. You're right.
All right. Thanks
yes.
for clarifying that.
Then another thing that was really bizarre is that all of the worst allegations only came 5 years after separation. Maybe it was 4.5 years after separation, but significant time after there was no more contact with Dad. And they didn't slowly come out. They came out with Miss McKenzie. She had a second meeting with Izzy, and as Izzy's leaving, she just suddenly blurts out all of these things. Oh, and you can tell my therapist. You'd think that she would tell the therapist that she has been working with for several years by now. So my time is out, but I hope you will seriously consider allowing this child to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client and beginning your argument.
My name is Sarah Peterson, and I represent the respondent, Denise Fossey. May it please the court, I want to start off on a big point that was made on the appellant's argument, which is parental alienation. With the parental alienation argument, appellant is asking this court to reweigh the evidence that was brought forth at trial. And to support his position at trial, appellant brought forth an expert witness to report and testify on parental alienation. And now he's asking the court to give the witness's report more weight in this court's review. Yet this court cannot reweigh evidence brought forth at trial. And the district court had already considered the appellant's claim of parental alienation in its December 3rd, 2020 order, where the appellant requested the court to allow his expert to interview the child and the parent to see if there was parental alienation. The district court denied this request because they did not see any inconsistencies that would suggest that the child was being coached or alienated in any way. This is because the minor child has been consistent in her disclosures since June 2018, when she made her first disclosure to her therapist. She then disclosed to Dan McKenzie 2 years later, even in that same path, and continued to make these disclosures to the professionals involved. Therefore, there's no inconsistency in her disclosures to suggest that parental alienation is here. Secondly, I'd like to point out that this court cannot make new findings of fact on a report that was not entered into the record. I want to make that very clear that Dr. Rittman's report that was included in appellant's brief was not admitted into the trial record, and therefore this court should not even consider that report at all.
But if you, one of the arguments appellant makes, though, that we, you know, certainly would be appropriate in for an appellate court to weigh in on, depending on which one, is the question of whether this was decided on the wrong, using the wrong standard, using the best interest factors rather than endangerment. You know, the argument being that effectively, given the child's age and the length of the suspension of parental rights, you know, the suspension of parenting, this is effectively, that perhaps this is the wrong standard, and then we could send that back. So could you please address kind of that, what I see as the underlying legal dispute here?
Absolutely. I do believe that the district court actually did address endangerment and the best interest factors. Both of those are required in order to restrict a parent's parenting time. And this court did hear all evidence presented and did make findings that if the child had contact with appellant, that she would be in significant emotional danger, thus satisfying that endangerment standard, and then further did a best interest analysis under the Minnesota Statute 518.17, addressing each factor and continuously finding that it was not in the child's best interest to have contact.
And Could you please point me to the particular page and paragraph of the order where the district court finds endangerment or the like? I guess because I was just skimming it after hearing Ms. Murphy's oral argument and was looking for that, but didn't immediately see it.
Yep, so it's actually on page 8, paragraph 25. At this time, any contact between the father and the child would cause the child significant emotional damage, and it is not in the child's best interest. I do want to focus on one of the best interest factors that has been addressed here already, which is the independent, reliable preference of the child. Now, the child is 17 at this point. When she first decided not to go to parenting time or expressed her wish to not go to parenting time, that was August of 2017. She was 12. And every single time she had met with another provider after that, she has continuously said, I do not want contact with that. I do not want contact with that. This position has not changed. And then at trial, the district court heard testimony from respondent and found that the respondent was credible in testifying that since the child has not had contact with the appellant, the child has actually been doing really well. When the child might have saw her dad or was afraid of seeing her dad or the possibility of seeing her dad, that is when she exhibited the anxiety and wanting to go into a safe room, having ideas of suicide. But now that she has not had that contact, she's been doing really well. And I'd also like to point out her grades, which also has been presented to the court today. There's one other piece of evidence that the court should not be considering today, which is the 2021 to 2022 grade report that appellant has submitted in its addendum. The 2021 to 2022 school grades were not a part of the trial record. The trial was in the summer of 2021. So that grade, that next school year hadn't even happened yet. But even considering the year before that, which was presented to the trial court, which the trial court did consider, there's two big factors I want to point out there, and that's that first semester was fall of 2020, still navigating the education system following the COVID-19 pandemic. And then spring of 2021, at the end of that semester, was the trial in these proceedings. And it is not unreasonable to think that a 15-year-old is aware of a trial going on where she might have to see her father again. So her decline in grades do have a reasonable basis. Like, and the court did consider all of
that's
it.
That's your supposition. I mean, you're, yes. It's, yeah, so we've had no, a lot you, of that you, in this
absolutely
argument.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Now, there are many facts here that the appellant has been bringing forth that do go towards those best interest factors. And it is possible that a different court may have made findings on those factors. However, the findings that the trial court made are supported by the record. And because of that, those findings are not clearly erroneous, meaning that the court has not abused its discretion now in suspending the appellant's parenting time. I do also want to touch lightly on the appellant's claim that the district court's decision to suspend his parenting time has functionally terminated his parental rights. Now, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518.17, subdivision 3, parents are afforded numerous rights regardless of custody designation, regardless of parenting time. These rights include access to information, notification of if a child has been the victim of a crime. And these rights may be waived by the district court to protect the welfare of the child. And here, the district court only waived one of those rights, which is the right to telephone access and reasonable access to the child, finding that that contact would endanger the child. But even then, the appellant still had all the other all other parental rights afforded to him under that subdivision. And to terminate a parent's parental rights would be to remove any right to access to information about the child, remove any right to petition for custody, parenting time, or decision-making authority. And if this court found that the appellant's parental rights were terminated, then that would logically conclude that any parent who has no parenting time has no parental rights. And that's really muddling the difference that the Minnesota statutes have between custodial rights and parental rights. And if appellant's parental rights were to be terminated, that is in a whole other process in juvenile court to terminate parental rights. And we do not have that here.
While you're pausing.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the marshal hears sort of a buzz on the speakers. Is it only me? But I hear a buzz, and Chief Judge Siegel hears it as well. Is there anything you can control over there, or no?
I can figure it out.
Well, okay, that's okay. I'm just wondering if it's a speaker. I think I just solved it. I apologize. Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was just you were pausing, and so I.
Yes. No worries.
I wanted to make sure that there was no distraction from both lawyers' arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Another issue that appellant has brought up is the qualifications of the guardian ad litem versus Michael Goldfarb, the parenting time evaluator, versus Dana McKenzie, the neutral evaluator of the records and the interview of the child. Now, I want to be clear, yes, Michael Goldfarb is a master of social work. He does have great credentials in the family law community. He is highly respected. He conducted his evaluation in 2017. The child's disclosures of sexual abuse did not come out until 2018. And it was then that the guardian ad litem, someone appointed by the state, determined that it was not in the child's best interest, or recommended that it was not in the child's best interest to have contact with appellant. And then even further, we have Dana McKenzie, another family law attorney who is widely respected in the community, who both parties agreed upon to evaluate all the medical records, interview the child, and make recommendations. And she also recommended the suspension of parenting time. And so this was that slow disclosure of sexual abuse, the slow disclosure of getting to the suspension of parenting time and determining that that is the appropriate action here. So when viewing the record in the light most favorable to the trial court's very detailed findings, the trial court did not err in finding that it was in the best interest of the minor child to have no contact with appellant, did not err in finding that any contact would cause significant emotional damage to the child, given the disclosures of sexual abuse, and thus did not abuse its discretion in suspending the appellant's parenting time.
So can I ask you a quick question? Is it true that none of the licensed personnel working with the daughter made a report of sexual abuse based on her allegations?
So a report was made. It is not known who made that report. There is some findings in Ms. McKenzie's report that she did not make that report, and the therapist, Ryan Meyer, did not make that report. The reason being, and this is also, explained in the Ramsey County Social Services letter, that the minor child was in a safe environment at that time. with mom. At that time that these disclosures came out, the child was not having contact with dad. And therefore, because there was no present danger, they did not have to make the report. They could if they wanted to, and somebody certainly did. We do have a letter saying that from the county that there's been a preponderance of the evidence of sexual abuse. But also the county determined that there was no safety concerns at the time, and so therefore no services were needed either. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but with that, respondent requests this court affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Peters.
Thank you.
Ms. Murphy, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to make it clear that there was no slow disclosure of sexual impropriety. It was some sort of nebulous something, and that Ms. Larkin puts in her report, but there are no details in that. There's no detail as to exactly what was wrong. They came out at the nth hour, at the final hour, when Dana McKenzie saw her the second time, and then this huge explosion of, oh, he touched me, and he did this, and he did that. And it was all at the end of their time together as she's leaving. So to say that is a very curious thing for a child to do is, at a minimum, it shows that something is wrong. Why wouldn't she be working with this therapist and saying, this is wrong and this is wrong? But that's not what they were dealing with. And Ms. McKenzie admits that that's not really what they were dealing with. It had been mentioned, but they were dealing with day-to-day anxiety. As far as Mr. Fossey's rights to his child, they were effectively cut off. Because although he still could see her grades and knows that she was failing in school, he also knows that without any input from him, this child is currently on 2 psychotropic drugs, bupropion, and she does, which is basically Wellbutrin.
Is this in the record?
Yes, it's it did come out in Ms. Fossey's testimony.
Thank you.
But I don't know that the levels were in there. But she takes bupropion and sertraline.
I'm sorry, this is a public record, and if it's not in the record, you really shouldn't be including it.
Right, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is that she mentions these two, that she doesn't mention the amounts. In any event, this child was put on psychotropic drugs without any input from my clients and without any consideration of what these drugs do. These both cause that child, have the potential to cause suicidal ideation. And in fact, the child has complained of suicidal ideation, and all of that is on the record. It is in Ms. Fossey's testimony that all this is happening. I believe that opposing counsel incorrectly cited endangerment. She said what the court said was that she would be subject to psychological harm or something to that effect. But she's using the standards listed in the best interest factors and not endangerment. As a matter of fact, it read in its entirety, the order says, I really can't find endangerment, but I think it's in this child's best interest. And it might be that in the first couple of times with the therapist, that child might be a little bit uncomfortable, but as we said previously, she had a very close relationship to her father.
If I may, yes. Did you argue to the district judge that the district judge should be using the endangerment statute, not the best interest statute, before trial?
Yes.
So that's in the
It should be in there, yes.
Okay.
But as far as her being a part of his family, it's not just that they can't see each other. This child has missed all the family births, deaths, weddings, and celebrations on her father's side, everything. Her father did an international celebration of peace musical piece that was widely appreciated. She missed her stepmother's celebration as one of the Twin Cities' six most inspirational people, as well as missing Ms. Rocky's photo exhibit on peace that was visited by three ambassadors. So, I mean, she's missed all of this side of the family. So to say that there's anything trivial about what happened to this kid in this whole experience is not accurate. This kid is going through hell, and I believe that this child should be given the right to see a therapist. Maybe she won't like it at first, but maybe we can get her on a path where she's actually able to succeed, because this kid has a lot of talent, a lot of talent. I mean, she's smart. She's personable. She used to be very well-known and well-liked. So I hope that you will give her that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your
Honor. That is the final oral argument for today's session, and so the court is now in recess.